You're listening to Seeing and Believing, a film and television podcast that searches for the sacred on screen. I'm Wade Bearden.
And I'm Kevin McLenathan. And finally, Wade, we have a music intro that is suitably dramatic for a podcast of our stature.
You know, Kevin, I love the smell of new movies in the morning.
I love them too. I love it a lot more than napalm, and that is as far as the comparisons between us and Apocalypse Now are going to go in this episode.
Listeners, we're going to be reviewing the new Spike Lee film debuting on Netflix, The Five Bloods.
We're also going to be taking a look at something much more low-key with our review of the new Judd Apatow movie. He teamed up with Pete Davidson to produce The King of Staten Island, and we're going to be taking a look at that today.
All that's coming up on this episode, episode 252 of Seeing and Believing. Outro epic music.
I see ghosts, y'all. I see ghosts.
What happens to all of us, man?
Have you seen them too?
Yeah.
Dad come to you at night. Storm and Norm comes to me damn near every night. Now he talked to you like he talked to me.
Yeah, come on.
I don't think so.
Come on.
Fist up.
Get in there, David. Get in there. Put your fist up, David. Come on. Go on, you too, Vin. Go ahead. Fist up, man.
Come on, Paul.
Listeners, we are here with episode 252 of Seeing and Believing. And Kevin, I am so excited. I mentioned this in the introduction, but we get some pretty formidable releases here this week in a season that's been understandably pretty bare for movies.
Yeah, they're not exactly what you would call action blockbuster fare, but they definitely are from names and filmmakers and actors that are big enough to seem suitably outsized for the summer movie season.
Yes. Well, listeners, this week's episode, it does begin with our discussion of 2020's probably biggest release so far, Spike Lee's The Five Bloods. Set in present-day Vietnam, The Five Bloods follows four African-American veterans who return to the site of America's disastrous war in order to locate the remains of their fallen squad leader, played by Chadwick Boseman, as well as a treasure trove they buried nearly half a century ago. Starring Delroy Lindo, Jonathan Majors, Clark Peters, Norm Lewis, and Isaiah Whitlock Jr., Spike Lee weaves together a tale of adventure, madness, trauma, and American history. Kevin, we both liked Lee's previous film, The Black Klansman, and it seems like now is the perfect time for another Spike Lee joint. My question to get us started, it's just pretty straightforward. Do you feel like The Five Bloods lives up to its near universal hype, or does it fall somewhere shorter?
I went into it primed really expecting a masterpiece based on the buzz that was surrounding it and the fact that Spike Lee was coming off of the success of Black Klansman. It seemed like he was really on a hot streak, so I was really geared up for a masterpiece this time, maybe even something that I liked better than Black Klansman, which I did enjoy, but didn't quite crack my list of the best films of the year for various reasons. So I was a little bit, I don't know, I was a little bit let down by this film, I guess. And I'm very bummed out about that because I went in really expecting something great. And what I got was, at least in my opinion, seemed a little bit uneven. And we can kind of get into that a little bit, because when I say uneven, I don't mean it's bad. I mean that it's got some really high highs and, in my opinion, some pretty disappointing lows. So that's where I ended up on. And I think we're going to have a lot to talk about for sure. But I don't know. For me, it felt a little bit disappointing. And that might be the fault of the hype more than the fault of the film itself. I'm curious to know your thoughts, though.
Well, I mean, I mentioned hype for a reason, because this is one of those movies that I think every cinephile was looking forward to, just because of the year and because of the moment in time, and then just because it's a Spike Lee picture. And the story is, it's intriguing, it's fascinating. I think the film it's passionate, I think it's prophetic, and it doesn't necessarily revise history as it rightly interprets history. But as much as there is to commend about the movie, I was frustrated by a great deal of the film. The scattered plot, some of the character choices, even moments when the audience is required to suspend belief. It feels kind of odd. And I wonder if it's because the script, which was originally penned by Danny Bilson and Paul DeMeo in 2013 and was rewritten by Kevin Willmott, was sort of a hodgepodge put together. And so we get one vision and we get another vision, and they don't fully gel. And so I think that's where the weakness of the film lies. It just, the plot itself. And yeah, I was disappointed too, Kevin.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what to attribute it to, because I'm not even sure how much of where we can speculate on where the unevenness comes from, I guess. I do think that it's definitely possible that Lee had a very specific vision for what he wanted to do with this film that resulted in some moments that are very powerful for how they do speak directly to contemporary concerns about race and justice and warfare. But it did seem like those parts kind of rubbed up uneasily against where it connected to the more conventional parts of the film, if that makes sense. This, of course, is a Lee film, so he does do a lot, especially in these later films of his, of really playing around with the intersection of the film's reality, where we are seeing actors playing characters on screen, and actual archival footage or archival photography that are sort of spliced into the film to remind us that essentially Lee doesn't necessarily want us to distinguish between, okay, we're just watching a story and we're going to, you know, enjoy ourselves with it, and then kind of the movie ends and we return to the real world. Lee is really trying to blur the line between the act of watching the film and the act of living in our world. And I think that's a really interesting territory for his films to occupy. I think for me, the problem comes when he doesn't really trust how he does that with image and editing, and where the script kind of tries to really put a button on a lot of these ideas that he is dealing with. So for an example, there's a scene where the four main characters, these ex-GIs, are walking down a street in modern-day Saigon. They're accompanied by their Vietnamese guide, and they're kind of, they've just exited a nightclub, and they're kind of just hanging out. And then in the middle of this conversation, they kind of almost stop, and they discuss exactly what certain what a certain famous black GI, what his experiences were while he was overseas on his tour of duty in Vietnam. And it's interesting. Like, it's interesting to have that information. And Spike Lee accompanies this with by intercutting actual images of this black soldier while they're talking about it. And that's interesting as far as it goes. I think the writing, though, just, it really feels flatly expository. And it comes across, at least for me, as if Lee's not really trusting in the editing and the overall shape of the film really bringing home these themes. And he really wants to just state them explicitly. And I think that reads almost as a loss of nerve, and it's something that the film ultimately didn't really need, in my opinion.
You know, I don't mind some of this in-your-face sermonizing. I think it's usually a negative trait in most films, but it works okay here for me. What really frustrates me about this movie is you do have this passion, and I mentioned prophecy, but it bounces between that and formulaic. And there were some shootouts in this film, especially this kind of big shootout at the end, that weren't just oddly placed and oddly staged for this movie. They would have been odd or weak in really any movie. And there's one scene where a character who is less nimble than everyone in a gunfight, wearing a white suit, stands out like a sore thumb. Somehow he manages to survive this entire deal and just wreak havoc. And it's moments like that when it feels like it's a passion project placed on top of a weak mainstream movie. And that's where the problem is for me. I enjoy some of Spike Lee's just, I mentioned this before, in-your-face messaging. And I think that some of that just works extremely well. And what he's trying to do is he's telling this, of course, fictional story, and he's superimposing these real-life characters in real-life events. Almost as if those characters are bordering the edges of the project. They are these ghosts that influenced this season in American life and this war and the plight of these individuals. This is almost a ghost film, a horror film. There's one scene where the characters are walking across a field, and we get them sort of walking towards the camera, and there's this cross dissolve, and they're suddenly further along. And it does feel for a moment that these individuals are translucent. We also have this playing with time. So the characters, you know, this is set in present day Vietnam. And you mentioned they go to Saigon, which is now Ho Chi Minh City. And these individuals should be somewhere around 70 years old. Most of them look a little bit younger than that. They meet characters that look too young to have known them during the Vietnam War. One individual has a daughter that, from what I understand, was conceived during the Vietnam War, but she's too young. The older actors play themselves in the flashback scenes, and there's no makeup done. And so Spike Lee, he's playing with memory and he's playing with time. And I think for some people it might be confusing, but I understand what he's doing, and I do appreciate all of that. And I just, you know, wish that the plot would have lived up to some of these I think really grand and I think pretty bold decisions throughout the movie.
Yeah, there's a lot of things about this film that make it read as more or less a war movie. The soundtrack is very martial, you know, the drums and the horns that we've heard in any number of war movies previously. And of course, you mentioned the shootouts. There's an early scene that's one of these flashback scenes where we see this squad of five men kind of going on this mission together and encountering resistance. And so there's a firefight that takes place. And it does seem to me almost, it seems like the war movie elements of this film are just, they're much less interesting than the other elements of the picture. And so for me, it seems a little bit disappointing that the film goes in that direction as much as it does rather than sticking with some of its strengths. And maybe this is a good time for us to talk about one of the lead actors, Delroy Lindo, in the role of Paul. Lindo is fabulous in this film. He's just utterly fantastic. And of course, in this film, Paul is characterized as a, you know, one of the squad. He's struggling a lot with PTSD. He has a very difficult, fraught relationship with his son, played by the last black man in San Francisco's Jonathan Majors as David, just another really good role. But Paul is, he's struggling with all these things. And he also, we come to learn, is a diehard Trump supporter. He even like spends half the movie wearing a red MAGA hat as they're in the jungle searching for this treasure. And Lee does a lot with this character that's very interesting, and Lindo as well, in really suggesting that this isn't a film that's going to cater towards popular or stereotypical visions of what a black man is supposed to be or what a black veteran is supposed to be. And over the course of the film, we watch Paul really just be sketched out as a very complex, very interesting character who has so much fighting within him, and so much, at least in I think the way that Lee wants us to interpret his character, he's dealt with so much injustice and anger at race relations in America for so long, and it's kept inside. It's combined with his wartime experiences in a way that really curdles and turns into something very toxic and also something very sad. And I don't know, I loved him, and I would have watched an entire film that was just about him being in Vietnam by himself, not necessarily dealing with all these myriad other subplots, but just trying to come to terms with who he is and what has happened to him and how that should play out in his life going forward.
Yeah, and he makes a number of radical decisions throughout the film. And I think most of those work because we understand, or we have a glimpse of the trauma that this character has experienced, not just in the war, but as a black man trying to navigate America. And we get this incredible, I think one of my favorite sequences in the film is when this group of soldiers, and this is a flashback, so this is during the Vietnam War, they're listening to the radio, and a propaganda message comes on, and it's addressed to, and she quotes, she says, the black GIs. And everything that is said in this message is true. How the country has let these individuals down, has push them to fight their war, and yet they don't welcome them back home as heroes. I mean, it's a great sequence because you think, okay, this is the quote-unquote enemy talking here, and they're going to try to lie and do whatever they can to get soldiers to turn their backs on America and their country and to fight against their you know, their fellow soldiers. But everything is true. And I think moments like that are just fantastic because you feel the weight of these characters. And of course, you know, the symbolism is almost on the nose at times. You know, these people never left Vietnam, right? And so they come back here, but it's as if they've been here kind of wandering around in the jungle like they are doing currently. They're searching for something, and they're searching for closure. And they're searching for something that will take their problems away. And part of that does involve this gold. Now, all that stuff is really wonderful. Some of those scenes are just real mesmerizing. But then you get characters who find gold in kind of odd places. I think a lot of this crew, at the very beginning when they meet each other, it's like, okay, they're, you know, they have this commonality. They fought together, but they're all very different people. They've grown since the war. They've changed since the war. And yet, with the exception of Paul's character and that great performance that you mentioned, the other men in the Bloods, they sort of just get absorbed into the collective, which is disappointing because at the beginning of the movie, we also get this subplot with Otis, who's played by Clark Peters. He does a very good job, and he meets up with a woman that he knew during the war. And I'm interested in hearing more about his story and the development in his story. And it kind of gets lost. There's another character who makes this sort of revelation to the group. He makes a confession to the group. And I'm like, oh, yeah, okay, I forgot about that. And I think the story loses some of those touches throughout this. And that's, you know, definitely one of the weaknesses throughout this film.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that I had as big of a problem with some of the things that you mentioned as you did. You are right that it does seem like Lee, or at least maybe the screenplay is, maybe spends more, lavishes more attention on some members of the Bloods rather than others. I think Paul and Otis are kind of the two that really seem to have a lot. There's a lot invested into shading out their characters and building them out and making them have more facets, I guess, than the other members of the Bloods. And I guess that is kind of a shame, just because there's these other possibilities represented by these other characters, but we just don't get as much of them. One of the films that I thought of while watching this film was actually The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, that Humphrey Bogart film about a trio of men who are, you know, off prospecting for gold. And over time, the prospect of this great wealth causes their alliances to shift and eventually causes them all to turn on each other. And I think one of the strengths of that film is just how simple and streamlined it is, right? Like there doesn't seem to be almost like a wasted minute in that film, because it's all kind of focused in on the triangle of these three men, how their relationships are formed over the course of the film, how their relationships shift and change over the course of the film, and how the changes that we do witness are all traceable back to kind of this gold, which is almost, the gold isn't the point. The gold is just sort of this catalyst for creating these changes. And it seems like Lee really is just so ambitious with what he's trying to do with everything else that the lines connecting all these characters get a little bit fuzzier. And I think in the end, it's a little bit more complicated than it should be. There's an entire subplot with a trio of French aid workers who are there to demine all of the landmines that are still remaining in Vietnam after the American War, as they call it. And that they don't really seem to serve a purpose in the narrative, which is a shame, because there's a lot of the movie devoted to at least introducing them and having them play some sort of role. And they're not really interesting except as a vehicle for maybe highlighting one aspect of the war that doesn't get talked about enough, which is the remaining landmines and unexploded ordnance that's still in the country. That's an issue that's important. It's a social justice issue. For this particular movie, it does seem to distract from what we as the audience are the most interested in, which is exploring the effect of the conflict on the lives of these four men.
Yeah, it's kind of a strange subplot, and the characters make strange choices. And I think the exploration is important here. And, you know, my grandfather fought in Vietnam. He experienced side effects of Agent Orange. And so this is a war that it's very fascinating to me to see the effects that it has on people firsthand, and to see how that is explored. Because in my experience, a lot of people that fought in Vietnam don't like to talk about what happened over there. At least it's if it is done, it's done in sort of vague generalities. And so a movie like this trying to get into that headspace. And I was also looking for more in the flashbacks. I think they kind of Peter out. And we do get this sort of fascinating take on Chadwick Boseman's character. So he is the commander who perished during the war, Norman, and they are going back to find his remains. All of that, finding the gold, finding him, it's all really easy, and maybe Spike Lee just isn't super concerned about that, but it does take away from some of the tension. And we do get to kind of figure out how he died. We learn a little bit more about him, and he becomes almost this Christ figure. And I wanted to mention this because towards the latter half of the movie, I mean, even throughout, but definitely in the latter half of the movie, we get a number of biblical references. So Paul's character, he quotes Psalm 23 as he's sort of going off in the woods.
Oh, that's such a heartbreaker of a scene,
It's a heartbreaker of a scene because he's yearning for that good shepherd. He talks about Jesus forgiving him of his sins. He talks about how God is love, how Jesus is his friend. And it feels like Spike Lee is firmly planting equality within a religious and even a Christian context. So when we learn about Martin Luther King Jr., we learn that his pursuit of equality is firmly attached to the scriptures. And this movie seems to connect it to that, that this yearning for equality occurs within or is rooted in this Christian context. So it's kind of a fascinating look here towards the end of the movie.
Yeah, that scene. Towards the end of the film, where Boseman's Norman shows up kind of in a vision to one of the characters, and they embrace, and a sort of reconciliation or forgiveness is offered there, is just, that's an absolutely, it's a beautiful scene. And it made me think a little bit of the way that Fonny is portrayed in some scenes in the film If Beale Street Could Talk, you know, that film that kind of didn't get as much love as maybe I expected it to. But there's a scene where Fonny's kind of the male lead of that film. He's black, and we get a shot of him kind of carving something like a carpenter, and it's just shot in this really warm light, almost placing him in this almost saintly celestial glow. And it's drawing a parallel between the way that Fonny suffers and sort of the way Christ suffers, and the way that they're both carpenters. And I thought of that scene from If Beale Street Could Talk in this reconciliation with this vision of Norman, because it does feel like there's just this deep hunger in all of the four bloods that we watch over the course of the film, where they hunger for justice. There's talk of reparations. They're going after this gold, essentially, as a way to sort of take back something for black people that the United States has never stopped taking from them since its very inception, right? And so there's this almost social justice element to their hunt for this treasure. And in this final scene with Norman, you get a sense that there's a balm on that anger and that cry for justice that is at least temporarily placed on this other character's heart who receives that embrace. And I think that this is a film that only gets stronger as it goes along, and I think it's because of scenes like that, scenes where Lindo's Paul essentially looks straight down the barrel of the camera and talks to us in the audience and says, essentially, you're not going to cheat me again. I'm going to take what is mine. And then he gives the Black Power salute. And he's a very complex, difficult character, but you really understand him in that moment. And moments like that and this reconciliation scene are just so galvanizing and really represent the best of what Lee is doing with this film.
Yeah, and you learn that one of the characters is suffering from a disease that will probably kill him. And he says, I will choose when and how I die. And this character wants agency, control, at least, at the very least, to say, hey, this is how I'm going to go. And I think those are powerful scenes. There's another scene where one character is bitten by the snake, and there seems to be a good deal of Old Testament imagery that equates fallenness to everyone, even people who are oppressed. And this is a great example of just Spike Lee not being placed in a particular box, not placing himself in a box, not allowing himself to be placed in a box, but making this passionate and prophetic cry. But then, you know, you follow it up with this sort of what feels like a lazy action scene, and we get kind of plotty, and I mentioned it before, formulaic, and that is the frustrating aspect of the movie. And you get the sense that, hey, there's this really fantastic, great movie here. We gotta pick through some of this debris in order to get to it.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I mean when I talk about this film feeling uneven, is it just has such high highs, and then to kind of have some disappointing stumbles after that is, I mean, it's a disappointment. There's no other way to put it. I think for me, overall, the highs kind of make up for those stumbles a little bit. But yeah, it's unfortunately, this film might end up in kind of the same category as Black Klansman, where I really like and even love a lot of what it's doing, but just I wasn't really vibing with some of its rhythms and creative choices.
Listeners, that is our review of Da Five Bloods. It's currently streaming on Netflix. If you've seen the movie and you have some thoughts, make sure to tweet us at CBelievePod, at CBelievePod. You can also email us, seeingandbelievingcapc@gmail.com. We would love to hear what you have to say about the movie, and we might even read some of those thoughts on our next episode. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back in just a few minutes. We're going to be reviewing the Judd Apatow, The King of Staten Island. We'll be right back. Listeners, that song was From My Heart by C. Schrei. We want to take a moment and thank everyone who supports us via our Patreon campaign. When you do that, you keep the show going. We have a number of different donation levels on Patreon, and one of our favorites is the What Can You Buy for $5 level. Kevin, I wanted to ask you that question today. Five Bloods, $5, what could you buy for $5?
Five-flavored peanut butter. So if you like peanut butter, okay, great. But you know what's better than peanut butter is peanut butter with lots of multiple flavors just swirled into it, sort of like a Neapolitan ice cream, but for your PB&J.
Okay. I love peanut butter. Sometimes I just eat peanut butter straight. And whenever I make oatmeal, I eat oatmeal almost every morning for breakfast, and I put peanut butter in my oatmeal. I think it's fantastic.
I don't know if I can endorse your life choices here, Wade.
I need the extra protein, but I always say, if you want the peanut butter, you got to earn it. So you got to do your reps in the morning, you got to run your miles, and then you get the peanut butter in your oatmeal.
I think I'm going to have to find a different incentive for my own exercise regimen, because I don't think that's going to really be doing it for me.
Listeners, you can get flavored peanut butter for $5, or you can support us on Patreon. Head on over to patreon.com/seeing_believing_podcast. Kevin, we also have something that I think has a great impact on the show. We put it out there this last week, and it is a survey to help us really get to know our listeners a little bit better and for them to provide feedback on what they like about the show.
Yeah, so of course, you know, supporting us financially is a huge help. Supporting us by sharing the show is a huge help, by rating and reviewing us on iTunes. Those are all great, but maybe more important than any of those is really just making sure that you let your voice be heard as far as like what we do with the show going forward. We want to make sure that what we're putting out every week is something that our listeners really like, that we're giving them more of what they like, and really just finding the niche for the show where we really can reach broad of an audience as possible, doing what we love and what our listeners love. So definitely head on over to our Twitter account where we've linked to that survey. I'll also drop a link to that survey in the notes for this week's episode. It's just a quick one-page Google Doc. It'll take you 5 minutes, and it's just really valuable to us. So we definitely appreciate all of your help in providing that info.
I love Staten Island. It's amazing. And people are gonna see it soon, trust me.
Well, if you love it so much, why don't you let me tattoo it on you?
No, I'm not gonna let you tattoo me again.
Fine. Well, I need somebody to tattoo. I'm running out of... Come on, Rich, what about you,
man? Don't even look at me, dude.
Why?
Your work is mad inconsistent. Obama ain't right.
I got the eyes wrong, okay?
He's not right. All right, man, this has hurt me. Right? I don't have any black friends anymore. I can't go to the barbershop no more. You got Obama wrong. Ain't nothing worse than that.
What are you, Igor? You want a dragon or something?
Oh, I love your tattoos. My brother, it's a spitting image.
Yeah.
It's my favorite.
It's one
no,
of the
no,
best.
No, no, no. This is my favorite. Oh, you killed that.
Yeah, I really worked hard on the eyes.
Welcome back to the second half of our show, listeners, where we're going to be talking about a film that, at least for me, is more immediately relatable than the experiences of Vietnam GIs. Sadly, can't claim that I know a whole lot about what it's like to live through combat as a GI, but I do know what it's like to be a 20-something underemployed white slacker. So I'm looking forward to plumbing my own personal experience for this next review.
Yeah, well, I don't have any tattoos, so I am limited on how close I can get to Pete Davidson. That I don't know if that'll pose a problem or not.
Well, I don't think it'll pose much of a problem. I, too, have not set ink to my perfect complexion, but at least you could yeah. also say that you weren't planning on putting together a tattoo restaurant. So
yes.
You got that in your favor.
Yes.
Listeners, The King of Staten Island's basic plot outline will be familiar to anyone who is familiar with the films of Judd Apatow. A boy realizes he is living in a state of perpetual adolescence and begins the journey to grow out of it. Apatow has made a lot of these films over the years, whether he's been directing or acting in a producer role, but the basic plot outlines of a lot of these films are the same. From the high schoolers of Superbad to Steve Carell's eponymous role in The 40-Year-Old Virgin, these are characters who are boys no matter how old they are. In the case of this latest film, that boy is the mid-20s Scott, played by Pete Davidson. This film is purportedly based on Davidson's own personal experiences and follows Scott as he struggles, or not, to find a direction for his life and copes, or not, with losing his father to a firefighting accident when he was young. Some standard Apatowian tropes apply, lots of banter, a questionable group of friends who may or may not be helping Scott realize his dreams in a healthy way, but the specifics are very much unique to this film and to Davidson's experiences. Wade, my question for you to get us started is pretty simple. You've seen a lot of Apatow films over the course of your life. How does this film compare to those? Do you find that it occupies a familiar place in his filmography, or do you think that this kind of does some new things and goes to some new places?
Yeah, so I've seen a ton of films that he's produced or executive produced. I think I've talked about Freaks and Geeks. I'm a fan of Freaks and Geeks. I know he directed a handful of episodes, and I think he was an executive producer. I think that show's fantastic. I'm a little light on some of the films that he's directed, and I haven't been a huge fan of those movies. So I've never been a fan of The 40-Year-Old Virgin, and I don't know if I finished Knocked Up, but I've watched enough of it. I just, this sort of crass comedy whole subgenre is usually not my style. And so I came into this movie, and it's almost the opposite of Defy Bloods, in that I didn't have very many expectations for the film. And yet I found it to be a deceptively mature tale that examines trauma, fatherhood, and prolonged adolescence. I enjoyed it more than I thought I would, and part of that is because of the lower expectations. But it's a movie that is funny. It does have that raunchy sort of crass humor. Some of that doesn't really work for me, but it's about growing up. It's about responsibility, and it's about being stuck and feeling stuck and not really knowing where to go. And I think in that sense, thematically, the film hits its core message pretty strong.
You know, it's really interesting that we seem to be almost the inverse of each other in our approach to Apatow in this latest film. So I've liked Apatow's previous films. I liked The 40-Year-Old Virgin. I liked Knocked Up quite a bit. Even though Funny People was, you know, overlong and maybe not wholly successful, I did appreciate a lot of what it was doing. So, you know, I don't know that I would call myself a super fan necessarily of Apatow, although I do like a lot of what he has either directed or helped produce. So I was kind of going to this film thinking like, this will be, you know, kind of a bird of the same feather maybe. And I have to say, I was very disappointed by The King of Staten Island.
Okay.
And I don't know if we can speculate maybe if the fact that you not being a fan of Apatow actually meant that what this film does primed you to like it more, whereas somebody like me who liked his past films a little bit more really struggled with it. So maybe we can talk about that a little bit, but yeah, I don't know. This is probably my least favorite of his films that I've seen.
You know, I like this movie when it's not trying too hard to be funny. So it opens with this scene, and Pete Davidson, he's driving, and he's not really paying attention, and he almost gets in a car accident, and he swerves, and as a result, the people behind him get in a car accident, and he just keeps driving, and he's, you know, obviously very shaken, and he just says, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. You know, no one's there, no one can hear him, I'm sorry. And I think it's a funny scene, but it also says something about this character, and it lets him let down his guard a bit. And we get a peek inside of his, I don't know, just kind of this fragile self. There's this other scene where these characters they're really into minor league baseball. I mean, just really into it. And I think it's just hilarious. And so touches like that really do work for me. And I found, too, that a number of conversations in this film are conversations where we get to read between the lines and truly peek into who these characters are. And it's these moments where they kind of let their guard down. There's one argument scene, and Pete Davidson is arguing with his sister. She's about to go to college. I think she's about to leave the next day or in a couple days. And it's sort of this frustrating argument. They don't understand each other. And yet, peeking in we're able to see who they are, and we're able to get a great image of loss and what loss can do at particular moments in time to people. And so Pete Davidson's character, he lost his dad when he was 7, and his sister, who's younger than him, she actually doesn't remember her dad. And so it affects her in a different way. And I think throughout the film, we get a number of those scenes where subtly Apatow gives us a window into the lives of these characters, and he doesn't push them too hard to change. In fact, sometimes I'm like, oh, I wish he would just get his act together. But it's really hard to do that for some people, and because of their experiences, and it's also hard to care for and to love other people when we find them struggling and when it seems like they can't get out of their own way.
Yeah, so I do think that you've hit on something that is maybe a central theme in most Apatow films, which is the concept of change. Is it possible for a person to change? Why do people change? And how does that change often take place? So the 40-year-old virgin is about a character who is kind of always struggled to be intimate with people, not just sexually, but just in terms of really opening up to them and sharing with them in a meaningful way. So when we meet him at 40 years old, he's kind of, you know, he's living in this world where he lives by himself and he's got his video games and his collector's items, and it's very comfortable and it's nice, but there's nobody who really knows him. Like, he doesn't really let anybody into that world. It's just he's got his possessions and his things, and he just sort of enjoys himself by himself. And Knocked Up, you've got somebody who's a lot like Pete Davidson's character Scott in this film. Seth Rogen's character is this slacker. He doesn't really have any direction in his life. He's got this harebrained scheme for a startup company that he wants to get going, but he never really finds the impetus to do it. And that changes when he gets a one-night stand pregnant and kind of has to figure out, okay, well, I have responsibilities now. How do I meet those? Funny People is about Adam Sandler's character kind of looking at the havoc that a certain lifestyle has wrecked on the people around him, and kind of contemplating, well, what do I do now? That's all really interesting. I think my problem with The King of Staten Island is it never really goes as deep into what the change is like for Scott. He doesn't really seem to... There's not really a moment in this film I can pinpoint where we're really let into Scott's inner psyche and kind of like understand, well, why would he want to change? You know, what is it like for him to change, not just his behavior, but also his perspective on life and even his heart? And I just don't see a lot of that reflectiveness in The King of Staten Island. It just seems sort of like he decides to change, and then over the course of a montage, he kind of does. And I didn't find that very satisfying.
Well, I think throughout the film, you have a character kind of, he just feels kind of pulled along. And he's told to do this or he's told to do that. He has a dream, and his dream is to open a tattoo parlor restaurant. But he doesn't really even do much about that. And he's, other people get him jobs, and he doesn't do a lot of reflecting on his life. And so as I'm watching, I kind of have this different reaction in that this is a character who can't stand to reflect on what's going on around him because it's too painful. Because if he does that, he has to fess up to a number of different mistakes. And it's not until he feels known or seen, it's not until he finds mentors, that he really is kind of able to do that. And he almost does that physically. He does that, in order for him to change, it's almost this physical working out, this physical discipline. And I think that's kind of this fascinating look at what it means to try to change and how we can even change or even hopefully start to change, even though we don't always know what's wrong. And during the beginning of the film, he's talking to someone who's kind of his secret girlfriend, And she says, he says that he's messed up in the head. And that's really all he can say, is he just feels messed up. And a lot of it stems from his personal experience. And I really haven't seen Pete Davidson in very many things. I've, of course, seen him on SNL. And I know his father passed away during 9/11. He was a first responder, a firefighter. And it really felt like a warm, personal performance here. And I like him. And in fact, I think the cast is one of the strongest parts of this movie. You have Bill Burr, who plays a great firefighter. You have Marissa Tomei, who plays Pete Davidson's mom. She's just fantastic here. And that makes up for some of the weaknesses of the movie. And I think the movie, just on, you know, from the very beginning, we look at it, it's too long. There's some subplots. There's one that involves a pharmacy, and it's just odd and kind of strange. And the way that Apatow connects, he introduces Bill Burr's character is a little bit weird. So there are some structural issues here, but I think at the core, it is a mature look at what it means to just be at a loss in life and just feel like you're stuck, and you have the power to change, but you almost don't realize you have the power to change. And I think that's something that a lot of people do experience, and it's a really tough rut to get out of.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that those elements are kind of there, kind of floating around in the film, and you can see some of that, you know, as one of these ideas as it kind of floats by you. For me, I think the problem is it never really coheres, though. I watching this film, I don't really think that Apatow does a particularly good job of showing us how Scott gets from point A to point B. Like, how does he go from being a pretty closed off, unambitious guy who just smokes weed constantly and kind of has this unresolved grief over his father's death? How does he really go from that to somebody who's kind of decided to make the change? It's sort of, he gets kicked out of the house and he has a moment of bonding with Bill Burr's character. But I guess wherever that point comes where he decides to change, or when that process is sort of ongoing in him, I think that's something that Apatow doesn't evoke as well as he does in 40-Year-Old Virgin or Knocked Up. I don't see any of this happening. It does happen. It is evident by the end of the film that Scott has changed and there are reasons for that change, but there's not really any, it doesn't seem like Apatow has really shaped Davidson's performance in a way that really lets the audience in on that change. At least for me, I don't know that I see a transition. It's sort of, it's almost a, not a night and day transition, but it's just, I want to kind of see more of an incremental step-by-step process, because I think that's what change really is, at least in Apatow films, is you don't have an all at once 180. And it's not just based on a single decision. It's kind of over time, these characters discover in themselves the capacity to change and the desire to change. And I guess the King of Staten Island, I don't really see that. It's obviously there somewhere, but whether it's Davidson's performance or Apatow's directing, it's just never really fully brought to the fore in a way that I found satisfying.
Well, I think you're right that change is a number of steps, but I think where I see this film is, I see Davidson's character taking the first one or two steps. So to say that he doesn't go from point A to point B, he goes from point A to point A B. You know, he's in the middle, and I think that happens when he begins to, I don't know if you would say make peace with his father's death, but come to terms with certain aspects of his father's death. And so throughout the movie, he says, hey, if you're going to be a firefighter, you shouldn't have a family. You shouldn't have a family because you live a dangerous life. And when he begins to hang out with Bill Burr's character towards the end, he goes on a couple journeys. And I don't want to go into too much detail because I think there's some surprise here. But he does have a sense of closure about his father. And that compels him to do what I think is to take the first step, because he hasn't really changed, right? I mean, he has a new mindset, but what is change, especially in a character like this? Well, you got to decide to make the decision, and that's a really big step. But perhaps a bigger step is to actually just live it out. And so he's in the process of saying, okay, I made the decision, I've changed my mind, my mindset, but now I've got to go forward. And so I think that's why this film works better for me, because it understands that change is this really long process. And at the end, Pete Davidson's character is not, you know, this successful married individual with kids. He's maybe a step closer to that, but he still has a long way to go.
Yeah, and maybe part of this, of my distaste for it, is just feeling a little bit I got a little bit fatigued while watching this movie, because I don't think that it works entirely as drama, for the reasons I've already stated. But I think maybe even more problematic for me, though, is the, I don't know, I don't think it's all that funny. And this might be, obviously comedy is subjective, but I'm curious for your take on the comedic elements of this film, since you mentioned that it made you laugh a lot. I found it to be very comedy light for comedy. And I don't know if that's, again, in the performances or just in the way that Apatow shapes them or fails to shape them. I do think that this film kind of, it goes for a while. And that's been something that maybe Apatow's always had kind of a weakness for, is not really knowing when to cut a bit of business that he finds amusing, but that just really kind of bloats the running time of his films. But I think that that problem is especially apparent in The King of Staten Island, and maybe kept me even more at arm's length than I would have been otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, no, I totally get that. I think there are dull aspects to the movie, and just some odd, just as I mentioned, some odd subplots. I don't quite get those. And in fact, you could cut them out, and you just straight cut them out, and you're good. I mean, there doesn't need to be any, you know, dialogue change or anything like that. I think the movie's pretty funny. And like I said, I think the aspects of the humor that I do like are not necessarily kind of the dirty, raunchy jokes, but some of those other, some of the other humor, some of the dry humor in this movie, and some of the humor that I actually didn't expect to find in the film. And, you know, one example is just a couple of guys getting just so excited about my minor league baseball. Those aspects, I think, work all right for me.
Yeah, I guess there's not really any accounting for taste and humor, but I don't know. It's just maybe I just don't have the right kind of insight into the humor of minor league baseball fandom, or I don't know, even just some of the interplay between Scott and his friends, which has ordinarily been part of the strongest part maybe of Apatow films, where it's just sort of a bunch of guys hanging out, bantering with each other and making each other laugh. And that's kind of been enjoyable in the past to watch. I guess in this film, I don't know that I really enjoy spending time with a lot of these characters. And given the fact that a lot of their interactions are maybe a little bit more shapeless, that maybe it accounts for why I couldn't laugh as much at this film as I did at some of his others.
Well, maybe it helps with expectations. Maybe that's why I appreciate this film a little bit more. Who knows? Listeners, maybe once so. Again, if you've seen The King of Staten Island, make sure to let us know what you think. It is currently available to rent, so you can watch it at home. Rent it on iTunes and YouTube and wherever you get your films. Make sure to tweet us at SeeBelievePod or email us seeingandbelievingcapc@gmail.com. Kevin, we've reached the part of the show where we recommend something from the world of television and or film to our listeners. What would you like to recommend this week?
I'm going to renew my plug for the Ken Burns documentary series, The Vietnam War, which originally aired on public television, is currently on Netflix. It's just, if you're familiar at all with Ken Burns documentaries, you know that he's a guy who really gives a lot, does a really great job of providing a lot of detail while also keeping the larger picture in view and providing what is often really important in kind of layman's historical studies anyway, which is a sense of perspective. And I think that his series on the Vietnam War really does a great job of giving a good overview of the conflict while also not neglecting the individual stories that give it specificity and really help us understand what it was actually like to live through various facets of the conflict. It came to mind for me while I was watching Defy of Bloods, mostly because of how Lee in that film talks a lot about the racial disparities in the Americans who were serving overseas in that conflict. And that's something that I learned for the first time through this Ken Burns documentary. So it's got a lot of really interesting stuff like that. And will really, even if you think you know the conflict, which I kind of thought I did, it really deepened my understanding of it so much more.
Yeah, I need to check that out. I've seen aspects of it, parts of it. I have not watched the whole thing, so I definitely need to watch that. And you know, Ken Burns' stuff is just, it's usually so good, and you can't pass it up. I am going to recommend a documentary. It is currently streaming on Hulu. It came out earlier this year. It's Spaceship Earth. It's directed by Matt Wolff, and it does not refer to the Walt Disney World Epcot ride. Rather, in 1991, a group of people built what they called Biosphere 2, a biosphere filled with a artificial jungle and coral reef and lodging, and a number of people were placed in this. It was a two-year experiment, and the goal was to replicate Earth's ecosystem. So if we ever went to Mars or another planet, we could sustain life within a biosphere. Now, they called it Biosphere 2 because Earth is, of course, Biosphere 1. It's not a documentary that's going to blow you away. It's a documentary that's interesting and that seems to probe exploration and even the idea of science. What fuels science? While at the same time, is there a way for pseudoscience to overrun or overshadow, in some people's mind, high-quality, peer-reviewed science? So it's one of those documentaries that I found just pretty interesting. Like I said, it's not going to blow you away, but it is a fascinating look at a group of people who did something that was at once extraordinary and also not very wise. So that's Spaceship Earth from Matt Wolff, and like I mentioned, is currently streaming on Hulu.
That's a documentary that's been on my to watch list ever since I heard about it, because it sounds like just such a fascinating premise. So I'm looking forward to catching up with it one day, hopefully when it's available for free streaming on a service that isn't Hulu, since I don't have that anymore. But I definitely have a really high interest in checking that out, and you make it sound good.
Yeah, I mean, it's just kind of an interesting watch, and it follows the group that put this together, and they have fascinating origins, which kind of are almost cult-like. So it's an interesting story. Listeners, we want to thank you for listening to this week's episode. It's brought to you by our Patreon supporters and ChristandPopCulture.com. As always, we want to hear your thoughts. You can also rate and review us on iTunes and Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. That is a huge help. And as we mentioned earlier, we have a Seeing and Believing listener survey. It's found in the show notes. Please fill that out. Let us know what you think about the show. We always want to make it better. Our producer is Jonathan Clausen, who every week helps us to search for the sacred on screen. I'm Wade Bearden. My co-host is Kevin McLenathan. And until next time, this is Seeing and Believing. We'll see you later.
You have been listening to Seeing and Believing, an official production of the Christ and Pop Culture Podcast Network. Please rate and review the show in iTunes and check out our other shows at christandpopculture.com/network. Theme music by Alexander Osborne and Lindsay Miz, used under Creative Commons License 3.0.
This episode was brought to you in part by the Enneagram and Marriage Podcast, an outreach dedicated to bringing joy, strength, intimacy, and purpose to couples seeking growth. Be sure to visit enneagramandmarriage.com to find your chemistry together again, or for the very first time.